Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 5. I'll be escorting another group from Whistling Pines, I replied. I'll be there from mid-morning and then Jenny and I are taking her son after that. Well, then I'll see you there, she said in an obvious dismissal. When I got to my front door, I managed to juggle the piccolo and sheet music as I picked up the morning newspaper, but sheets of music flew from my grasp when I tried to twist the doorknob. I slipped the piccolo in my pocket and was gathering the scattered paper when Jenny pulled in the driveway. She helped me retrieve the music and opened the door. We set the music on the kitchen table for later sorting. I pulled her close and kissed her. Are you happy to see me, or do you have a banana in your pocket? She said in her best attempt at a Mae West impersonation as she pressed her hips against me. Actually, it's a piccolo. She pushed me back and cocked her head. A piccolo? She asked. I reached in my front pants pocket and took out the tiny case. Dolores gave it to me when I took a picture of her toe. Back up. Why did you take a picture of her toe? Why did she give you a piccolo? I took her hand and led her into the kitchen. I think this is better explained over a glass of wine. I took a bottle of California Chardonnay from the refrigerator and opened the screw cap. Jenny took 2 wine glasses from the cupboard. We sat on cracked vinyl chairs at the formica table that I'd acquired at a garage sale the week I moved to Two Harbors. The entire house was furnished in garage sale or hand-me-down furniture that fit my Whistling Pines salary. The wine glasses were cut glass lead crystal, a bargain acquired at an estate sale, and the only matching pieces of glassware in my kitchen. Jenny neatly arranged the pile of music to make space for the glasses and wine bottle. Dolores has a black toe, and she was trying to take a picture of it with her cell phone. It seems that the doctor doesn't charge for email messages, but she has the Medicare copay for office visits. After I took the picture, she gave me the piccolo. If Dolores had the piccolo, I assume that it's high quality. I'm not an expert, I replied, but it's sterling silver and it must be valuable, I said as I opened the case and assembled the pieces. I showed her the Gemeinhardt logo and sterling silver markings. Can you play a piccolo? Maybe. She sipped her wine and leafed through the stack of music as I returned the piccolo to the case. Can you get familiar with this music before tomorrow night? She looked up at me and back at the stack. I should be able to skim the music and not embarrass myself. It'd be better if I could spend the day working through it on the piano. Except that you have to deliver a van full of senior citizens to the fair in the morning, and then you promise to go to the fair with Jeremy and me tomorrow afternoon. That leaves almost no time before the evening concert. Like I said, I can skim the music and probably not embarrass myself. Jenny sipped her wine and looked back to the stack. I suppose I should finish my wine and go home so you can do your skimming tonight. I reached across the table and squeezed her hand. I can skim it in the morning before I go to work. After all, what's the worst they can do if I screw up? Fire me? Whistling Sousa, Chapter 11, Saturday Morning. I woke to tingling in my right hand. When my eyes opened, I saw that Jenny's head was resting in the crook of my elbow. Her blonde hair was jumbled, and her face looked as if it was porcelain, spider-webbed with tiny blue veins. The sheet was pulled to her chin, and her right knee was resting on my thigh, her arm across my chest. When I shifted, her skin stuck to mine, and her eyes fluttered open. "Are you getting up?" she asked. "I need to pee," I said, lifting her arm from my chest and shifting to the edge of the bed. "Not the most romantic opening line I've heard," she replied. I rolled back and cupped her chin in my hand and kissed her gently. "I'll be right back." You may want to brush the fur off your teeth if you expect me to be friendly, she said to my back as I scooted across the cool hardwood floor to the bathroom. On the way back to bed, I closed the bedroom window and then I slipped under the covers. I was chilled, the overnight temperature having dipped into the 60s, and I'd turned off the furnace for the summer, leaving the bedroom temperature only slightly warmer than outside. I pulled the comforter over us. Jenny recoiled from my goosebump-covered legs. "Stay on your own side until you generate some body heat," she said, retreating to the far edge of the double bed and holding me at arm's length. I swept her hand aside and pulled her close. She shrieked in response, which led to a wrestling match under the covers and eventually to a long kiss. "Is the piccolo in your pocket?" she asked playfully. "I'm not wearing pants." Whistling Sousa, Chapter 12. The residents were lining up for the van when I brought the sign-up sheet from my office. Wendy pulled the van under the portico and was helping load a scooter onto the hydraulic lift as I checked the names off the list. Once everyone was loaded, I was left standing with Ann Micres Allen, one of the volunteer chaperones. Her father, Ted Micres, was on the list, but nowhere in sight. "I haven't seen your father this morning," I said to Anne. "I spoke with him on the phone just before I left home," she replied. "He was excited about going to the fair." We were interrupted by Howard Johnson, who was pointing to the parking lot. "I think Ted decided to drive himself," Howard said, pointing to a vintage, rusty Oldsmobile 88. One of its back wheels was hung up on a concrete barrier. Anne and I walked to the car. The rear wheel off the ground was spinning. Anne knocked on the window, and when Ted saw her face, he floored the accelerator, making the engine race and the wheels spin even faster. He was hunched over the steering wheel as if he were racing down the road. Anne knocked again, and he seemed surprised to see her still standing next to him. He looked at the speedometer and kept the engine racing. I opened the door and reached in, noting the speedometer reading of 135 miles an hour, before I shut off the engine and took the keys out of the ignition. "Ted, where are you going?" I asked as I handed the keys to his daughter. "I'm driving to the fair." "But you signed up to take the van," I said. I gently took his arms and helped him stand. "Why would I take the van when I can drive myself?" Anne pocketed the keys and took her father by the elbow. "Dad, the doctor says you can't drive anymore. Where did you find the car keys?" "I lost the other set, but I always keep a spare set in my handkerchief box." "Are there any other sets in your apartment?" she asked as she helped him up the van step. "I'll have to check my toolbox. I might have another spare there," Ted replied. After Ted was safely seated, Anne shook her head. "I took two sets of keys out of his apartment after he blacked out last month. I told him he couldn't drive anymore, but I had no idea he had more keys." She hesitated, then said, "Can I leave the car where it is for now? I'll get it towed to my brother's house. My nephew just got his license, and this might be the perfect vehicle for him to drive around town." With Ted's turmoil, I spent the morning walking the fairgrounds with Abigail, Abby Brown, and Peggy, Ski Zeminski. They're both mobile, and it was an easy walk with two of the more lucid and funny residents. It left me in good spirits, and when I emptied the van at Whistling Pines, I was looking forward to my fourth trip of the fair, this time with Jenny and Jeremy. When I met Jenny at the gate, Jeremy was already wired. "Let's start at the Midway, 'cause I want to go on every ride at least twice." He raced ahead while Jenny and I followed, holding hands. By the time we got to the booth that sold wristbands for unlimited rides, Jeremy had linked up with two of his friends. The three boys were in awe of the dozen fair rides set up on the small fairgrounds and were plotting the sequence of rides and food for their afternoon at the fair. Jeremy raced back to Jenny, who was reaching for her wallet, before he got to us. Mom, Could you guys kind of disappear for a while? Jeremy asked, looking over his shoulder to make sure his buddies didn't see him talking with his mother. I could buy a wristband and meet you somewhere later. Most places in the world, a mother's mental alarm would be clanging if her young son asked to traverse the fairgrounds with his buddies. Two Harbors isn't like most of the world. Daytime crime is so rare, Jenny had no qualms about setting Jeremy loose with his friends for the afternoon. As we walked away, I said, "You know he'll be on a sugar high for the rest of the weekend." "I doubt it," she replied. "Those three will go a few rounds on the tilt-a-whirl, and they'll be tossing their cookies into a garbage can before we go home. So your role in this is to bankroll the trip and stay out of sight?" I asked. Jenny smiled. "I've heard it only gets worse as they get older." She steered me to the Lutheran church lunch counter. "I missed lunch. Let's grab something to eat and get out of the sun for a while." We walked into the Lutheran lunch counter, housed inside the steel-sided building that looked like a barn with picnic tables. I ordered a cup of coffee and a slice of apple pie. Jenny ordered a Cobb salad. The woman who took our order had a round face and a big smile. She wore a hairnet and a white apron stained with ketchup and mustard. The aroma of grilling onions and French fries filled the space. "Are you getting nervous about your directorial debut?" she asked as we sat at a picnic table. We were between mealtimes and most of the tables were empty. "I've been too busy to think about it since I leafed through the music over coffee," I replied, "but thanks for bringing it back to the surface." She smiled as she tore open a packet of low-fat French dressing and drizzled it over the salad. "My mom and dad will be here in an hour. I assume you forgot to invite your mother." "Dang it," I said with feigned distress. "It slipped my mind." "Not to worry," Jenny said. "My mother called your mother and told her about the concert and suggested we have dinner together afterward. Mom said Audrey sounded very excited." "You know, I don't see this going well. I can't imagine people more polar opposite than our parents. Just try to make sure the conversation steers clear of politics. Luckily, there isn't an election until November." "I think they're all polite enough to respect each other," Jenny said, as she sliced up her salad, evenly distributing the toppings. "Mother isn't known for her tact. Now I can worry about the concert and the tempest at dinner to follow." "Life could hardly be better," I groaned. "The concert will be fine," Jenny said. "I'm sure the musicians are professional, and they'll perform well regardless of the change of director." "Great, you're trying to make me feel better, but now I feel useless. I suppose the band could play with a trained monkey holding the baton." I felt the picnic table shift and turned to see a middle-aged man dressed in a white golf shirt and black shorts. He carried a black musician's case and had an enormous walking cast on one foot. "I'm John Carr," he said, offering his hand. "I'd like to think I'm more than a trained monkey when I'm conducting the band." I shook his hand and tried to find some words to explain my flippant comment, but he cut me off. "Don't worry. The band is very experienced, and the director's job is mostly to make sure we're all playing the same song and start at the same time." "What happened to your foot?" Jenny asked. John squirmed. "I won't admit this to many people, but I broke my heel jumping off Elgin Falls. I'd done it 1,000 times as a kid, and I was there with my wife watching a bunch of teenagers jumping in. Well, it just got kind of crazy from there. The kids dared me. Let's just say my wife isn't pleased with me." "You jumped off Elgin Falls?" Jenny asked, briefly looking at the gray in his hair and trying to guess his age. "It's not the craziest thing I've ever done, but it ranks near the top of the list, and it was a double dare." "You seem like such a button-down guy," I said. What tops the list?" "I have this really crazy friend named Albie. When we were teenagers, we dared each other to jump off the ore docks into Lake Superior. You jumped off the ore docks? Jenny asked, somewhat in shock. I tried to envision the height of the docks where the big ore boats are loaded with taconite pellets and guessed they were 200 feet above the water. That's like cliff diving in Mexico. We never made it on to the docks. We climbed the security fence and were sneaking on to the docks when a railroad guy saw us and chased us away. Even though Albie is sad we never made the jump, just planning the attempt still ranks at the top of my list of questionable actions. Albie still gives me a bad time about being the one who chickened out. He paused and then added, "That's probably just ahead of the time Roger A-Bomb Anderson and I mixed fuel oil with fertilizer. We set off an explosion in a wood pile that cracked windows in the Catholic Church and rained splinters over half the town." I looked at the instrument case he'd played on the table and sized it up. "You're playing alto sax tonight?" The doctor said I shouldn't lift anything, so I figured I should stick with the alto rather than the baritone sax until I get out of the cast. "Hopefully you'll be well enough mended to direct the band again next spring," Jenny said. "That should be no problem, although I am building a zipline course for my kids, and it looks pretty tempting," he said with a smile. He used my shoulder to lift himself up from the picnic bench and picked up the saxophone case. "I'll see you in a couple hours under the tent." He stood and lifted his cast. I'd say break a leg, but somehow that seems inappropriate. "John's an interesting guy," Jenny commented as he walked away. Somehow I had expected the band director to be more of a milquetoast person than someone who'd jump off the ore docks on a dare. Musicians are pretty diverse, and many of them are out of the mainstream, some further than others, I said. Back in the Roaring Twenties, professional musicians were the bad boys of entertainment, and because of the hours playing evening concerts and then the time required to emotionally wind down afterwards, they resorted to a mixture of alcohol and drugs to be awake for concerts and to fall asleep later. That didn't end with Prohibition. Think of all the craziness at Woodstock and the whole Haight-Ashbury music and drug scene. I guess I'll withdraw my earlier comments, but it just seems like the Two Harbors Band shouldn't be part of the craziness. They're all local folks who are going to school or holding down jobs and are pretty well woven into the community. Based on what the tuba player told me, the trombonists and tubists are all nutty and take great pleasure in irritating the rest of the band members. There's at least one man or woman who's in the midst of sex reassignment, and one bassoon player who irritates the others by skipping practices, showing up late for performances, and dressing provocatively. We watched Jeremy rush to the door of the food building and scan the dark interior looking for us. He hurried to our table and said, "I need some more money." His shirt was already stained with chocolate, ketchup, and mustard. Jenny fished a $5 bill from her fanny pack and held it out. "This means you'll have to take the garbage out the rest of the summer, when asked and without complaint." "Okay," he replied as he snatched the bill from her hand. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 13. Saturday, late afternoon. Dozens of musicians were talking and assembling their instruments behind the bandstand. Each nodded politely as I passed. I shook a few hands and accepted the well wishes of the three flutists, who ranged in age from 12 to 60. As expected, the official warm-weather band uniform was white shirts over black slacks, but the variety was endless, from the virtuoso eighth-grade clarinetist who wore a white Hanes t-shirt over black biker shorts, to an octogenarian French horn player in his starched white shirt with a red bow tie under a handsome black suit. With the temperature approaching 80 degrees, I was already sweating in my white golf shirt and hoped I wouldn't end the evening by falling into the French horns with heat stroke. Brian Johnson was removing his tuba from its huge case. He was dressed in a black polo shirt and white shorts, the opposite arrangement of everyone else. "Do you have any words of wisdom for me before I screw up this event?" I asked. "You're already halfway there."
"I am?"
"You're wearing dark pants, so no one will know if you wet yourself," he said with a smile. "Tuba humor," I said, feeling my tension break. "That's what we're best at." He inserted the mouthpiece and blew a few deep resonant notes and then ran up and down a scale. "Still works." "Anything that I should expect but don't know enough to ask about?" He cocked his head and thought. "I guess there are a couple of things you might want to keep in mind. Keep an eye on Keith, the third trombone. He likes to push Ray Hopkins' toupee with his slide."
"You're kidding?" I asked.
"It happens at almost every concert." "I'm a little concerned about the French horn player in the suit," I said, nodding toward the octogenarian with the bow tie.
"Don't worry about Frankie," Brian said. "He has bad circulation and wears long johns all summer. He's also very classy and takes the band very seriously."
"You're dangling a hint that there are others who are less serious?"
"How many tuba players does it take to change a light bulb?" he asked.
"3. One to hold the bulb and 2 to drink until the room spins."
"Anything serious that needs preparation?" I asked, grinning but shaking my head.
Brian leaned to look past me and nodded to someone. I turned in time to shake hands with a musician about my height with blonde hair tied in a ponytail and a white polo shirt that was stretched tightly over surgically enhanced breasts and black shorts.
"You must be the new conductor. I'm Jesse Bowden," she said, shaking my hand with a firm grip.
As Brian had warned, Jesse was in the process of undergoing a sex reassignment, and his/her appearance was a blend of strong male facial features and a somewhat deep voice and overly enhanced breasts and female mannerisms.
"I'm pleased to meet you," I said.
"Everyone says you're a very talented musician," Jesse replied. "I hope you decide to continue with the band after John recuperates."
"Thank you."
As Jesse walked onto the bandstand, I asked if there would be any other surprises. Brian cocked his head again, and after a few seconds, he replied, "Sheila."
"Who's Sheila?" I asked.
"She's the bassoonist. She's attractive, always late, usually dressed formally, and arrogant. I guess that all the women in the band hate her, and half the men in the band would like to get in her bedroom. The other half of the men are impotent, prepubescent, or gay."
"How will I recognize her?" I asked.
"She's the only bassoonist, but you'll know who Sheila is as soon as you see her." He smiled and walked to the back of the bandstand, arranging a stool next to the trombones. I'd scanned the concert crowd as I walked to the podium, but my mother was nowhere in sight. It was easy to pick out Jenny's blonde hair. She was sitting with Jeremy and her parents near the center of the crowd, and she gave me a million-dollar smile. The musicians responded with quiet, professional attention as I crossed in front of them and put on my best game face, even though sweat was trickling down my back. I mounted the podium and nodded to the oboe player, who played an A, which the other musicians tuned to. I noted the empty chair between John Carr with his alto sax and the lone oboe player and wondered if an extra chair had been put onto the bandstand, but then remembered Brian's warning about Sheila. As the tuning note died down, a commotion at the back corner of the bandstand caught my eye. Sheila had arrived. Sheila had neatly coiffed blonde hair and was wearing a black cocktail dress that clung to her well-toned body. Tiny straps were the only things keeping the top from revealing excessive cleavage. While there were many attractive women in Two Harbors, including Jenny, Sheila was in the Hollywood starlet category. The entire band was ready to play when Sheila gave me a pouting smile that said, "I might be late, but you'll forgive me anyway, won't you?" As she slipped through the seated band members,
stepping on toes and wiggling her behind in faces. She held her bassoon high in her left hand. Sheet music was tucked under her other arm. Her right hand was clutching several brown pill containers. I hope the pill containers contained pre-wetted reeds and not meds Sheila needed to perform. I saw several musicians rolling their eyes or shaking their heads. After she tripped on John Carr's walking cast and offered him an apology, she sat in the empty chair next to him and started to arrange her music. As she sat, her short dress exposed long, tanned legs. I did the only thing that came to mind. I stalled. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Peter Roberts, the recreation director at Whistling Pines, and I have the honor of filling in as the guest director for the Two Harbors City Band tonight. Behind me, I could hear Sheila shuffling her chair and the sound of squeaking as she put her reed in place. After a few more stalling comments, I heard a few chirps from the bassoon as Sheila tuned it. When I turned back to the band, Sheila was smiling, and Brian Johnson was giving me an I told you so look. John Carr gave me a nod of encouragement. I raised my baton, and the musicians' instruments all came to attention. When I made the downstroke, a miracle happened. The band played perfectly. My apprehension melted away, and I found myself flowing with the music. When I introduced the second song, I saw my mother standing in the back corner of the tent. It was hard not to notice her. She was dressed in her typical caftan that looked like it might have been stolen from the costume room of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. She waved vigorously, as if I couldn't notice her, which sent her dozens of wrist bangles clanging like a separate percussion section. I gave her a discreet nod, and we went on with the concert. We took a short intermission after six songs, and I walked among the musicians, shaking hands and thanking them. As Brian Johnson had told me, they were an amazingly diverse group with ages spanning 60 years and occupations from mining engineers to high school students to commercial fishermen, all bound by their common love of performing instrumental music. And then there was Sheila. She gushed forward, pressing her hand into mine, egregiously violating my personal space on the crowded bandstand. Up close, I could see the makeup that enhanced her appearance from a distance now showed crow's feet at the corners of her eyes, making me think she was closer to 50 than my initial guess of 30. "I am so sorry to be late, but I just lost track of time," she gushed in a breathy Marilyn Monroe voice. "I'm Sheila O'Keefe." "Peter Roberts," I replied, shaking her hand. "You are doing a wonderful job, Peter. I'm so pleased you were able to fill in for John on such short notice." She had a way of carrying herself and speaking that made me feel like I was the only person of importance in the world. I broke away from her spell briefly and saw three clarinetists shaking their heads in disgust. "Thank you. As I told the audience, it's an honor to be asked to direct this fine group. Now, if you will excuse me, I have to check on the tuba player." The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.